236, Murdoch and Sons against the State of Indiana, and now.
Morning, Your Honor. This case is actually went to full bench trial and was Murdoch and Sons Construction against Golden General Construction. State of Indiana was dismissed out in source prior to the trial. I had a resettlement with both Golden and Murdoch. So this case comes to you after a full bench trial on essentially three issues. Murdoch was ruled against constructive acceleration, was ruled against the breach of contract claim and payment on the construction bond. Background, this case arose out of the need in the state of Indiana for prison construction back in the late 80s, early 90s. The state was under mandate to increase prison space. They had plans through Department of Administration to construct a maximum security facility in Wabash Valley, which is just off of Terre Haute, the Wabash Valley Correctional Institution. This was level 6 housing, maximum security. In this process, around 1991, Golden General Construction became the general contractor of this particular phase 4 maximum security unit. Golden's contract amount was for just under $7 million, or $6.97. Murdoch & Sons Construction at the time was one of the three largest African-American construction companies in the state of Indiana, had a buying capacity of over $10 million, was capable of performing any level of construction. They have been encouraged by the state to become more involved in state construction and submitted a bid for the masonry portion of the construction of the prison.
Seriously, why did they come in at the last minute? I didn't understand it, because obviously the state solicited bids from several, only two bids, and they were higher than Murdoch, obviously. But why was this a last minute thing?
Well, it was not as last minute, I think, for Murdoch as it was for Golden receiving the bid. Murdoch was encouraged, and during this time of receiving the letting, apparently was contacted by someone in the state administration to say, hey, why don't you guys prepare a bid and get in on this project, which they did. As in all construction projects, the bids being sent in and submitted are done at the last minute, because that precludes anybody from undercutting somebody else's bid because they know it's just ahead of time. So in that circumstance, Mr. Golden had last minute time to actually review bids and determine who he was going to select as a subcontractor.
And was he obligated to take the lowest bidder?
He was obligated to take the lowest bidder as long as it was a reasonable bid. If he determined it was an unreasonable bid, I believe he could have rejected it. This particular prison was a maximum security prison. It was constructed of a myriad of maximum security cells, and the primary concern in this prison was that it be solid construction. That since it was being constructed by a masonry block, and a masonry block has open cells in the block, that each block was to have what is called rebar or iron rods in each cell and on each course. And then after the rebar was in place, then the grout, continuous grout like cement, would be poured into the cells to make them solid, to preclude anybody from burrowing in, from making holes, hiding contraband or whatever within the walls of the prison.
This type of construction was made known to Murdoch before they did?
Yes, Your Honor. And the bid itself, in review, under testimony of Murdoch's employees, did account for rebar, grout, block plane numbers, of the masons. The original numbers in terms of rocks of block plane and the grout and rebar was separated in the bid, but they were accounted for. Some basics in terms of construction is that Murdoch was a union contractor. He was required to use union labor on his picker site.
Was he required to use that particular union?
Yes, they had the jurisdiction for the Terre Haute, Wabash Valley area.
Because the only surprise appears to be the fact that these guys were laying block at a low pace, as opposed to the cramped quarters, the rebar, and the more complicated. All that was taken into consideration in the bid.
Yes, Your Honor, it was. In fact, the bid the bid is included within the appendix. It will indicate in certain areas that the bid was based on somewhere between 100 and 120 blocks per day per man. The normal block laying of a mason, and bear in mind, this is just the case, all the masons were doing, the block laying masons, was laying block. They didn't touch the rebar, they didn't touch the grout. All they did, they were on a scaffold or on the ground, whatever height they are, they turned around, they grab a block, they put it in place, cement it, move around, grab the next block, put it in place.
Well, were the rebar and the grouting people just waiting for them to lay the next block? Were they standing around waiting because they were going
well, at the beginning, but once the construction was underway, then you have walls that get up a certain height, up to 4 foot. The masons then move over to the next wall, which is ready for them. They start working. The rebar grout guys go in and finish over here.
So they lay a section, and then the rebar people come in after it's laid?
Yes and no, Your Honor. There's two types of rebar, vertical and horizontal. By contract, the blocks are laid to a course of about 4 foot. Okay. The vertical rebar is installed up in beyond the 4 foot and is put in every cell. So that is there waiting when the masons get to that particular area to start to work. The horizontal rebar goes into each course. So what you do is you have a lead man, lead mason, he lays the first block, the guys lay down the block and everything. That lead man then calls and says, you know, rebar. So the iron workers then come and lift a piece of rebar, which is just a rod, put it in three notched out blocks, and then you gotta start laying block again. There's nothing magic, there's nothing complicated about the product.
But by the very nature of what you're doing, slows it down.
Sure, sure it does. And that was testified to by, Matthew Bowden, if you look through the testimony, he's probably the best hands-on guy that there was, and even by Mr. Perry, who was the state architect and director of work, he said that it was not a complex project by construction standpoint. It was a little bit more time-consuming. Now, going back a little bit more time-consuming is that a good mason on a minimum reinforced wall, and by minimum reinforced is that almost every block mason job block even has a rebar. It just doesn't have it every cell. It will have it every 4 foot, every 6 foot, in the corners, it's there. But on a normal wall, you can anticipate that a mason should be able to lay about 200 blocks in a day. Given the rebar, it was testified to by the expert that was brought in, was testified to by Mr. Bowden, who had 30 some odd years of masonry experience, that he would anticipate that they should have knocked them down to about 150 blocks per day, per man. What they achieved was 50 blocks per day per man, which means one block every 10 minutes, which means that's picking up a block, he's putting it down, he's playing with it, he's doing whatever, but he's only getting one block every 10 minutes. Now, the rebar caused problems on a normal construction site. You have to take the rebar, so you have to lift it up, lay it down over the rebar.
The problem is, and you're trying to discover this early on, is this, if you're driving Indianapolis, it takes 3 hours, and you get to Wadeville after an hour, you know you're way behind, right?
Yes,
you're not going to get there in 3 hours.
Right.
They discovered this in January.
Yes, sir.
Now, why they put up with this for months afterwards, because you try to say, well, there's notice and there's an implication here that there was a work I guess, what is the name for it? You have to call it. A violation. What do you call it? What you're trying to claim. You're trying to claim some sort of a labor problem.
Well, actually, Your Honor, our claim is in form of an excusable delay. You're not actually claiming it as a classic labor dispute.
Well, the excusable delay has to be based on something that's beyond your control.
Correct.
And why is it beyond one's control to say to these guys, you either rate 120 an hour, a day, or you're out of here?
Well, Your Honor, from January through June is exactly what they did. They not only did that, they had turnover, they fired people, they changed crews. They had their original supervisor foreman, who was Matthew Bolton. They brought in another supervisor, thinking maybe they could change management. They designed a special H-block to handle the rebar so that the ends were broken out. So all the things, instead of looking over the rebar, all they had to do was set it down, twist it in place.
Did the union still get work?
I would imagine they get work.
What? Doesn't reputation for somebody that whatever you want to call it, drags, says that they don't qualify anymore? I don't understand how this union can keep supplying labor if they're going to work 40% rate.
Well, there's two things that states to do. Number one is the state recognized that. Even Mr. Perry's testimony indicated that the next phase, which was also a master security phase in that prison, they did away with masonry and they went to precast and had it fabricated elsewhere and dropped into place.
So they didn't have to deal with that union.
So the mason just didn't have to deal with that union whatsoever. Number two is that goes to the whole crux of our argument, is that the labor slowdown, though not a classic labor dispute, was in itself a cause beyond control. It was not an effect. It was a cause.
If you had a lockout, that would be a classic labor.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. But yeah.
That wasn't an option.
No. There was a meeting with the international, meetings with the locals. Nothing that this accomplished contractor was able to do, proven management techniques, to try and get these guys to move any faster than what they were doing.
What were the masons accomplishing by this? More masons on the job?
Well, they worked a lot longer on this particular section than they're supposed to. Mr. Murdoch expended over $2 million additional dollars on this project, and the bulk of it went to Mason Labor. And there was another phase coming up. So, yes, don't kill the job, we get to work. And they were getting away with it. And they were flexing their muscle. Nothing that was ever able to be done on the job in terms of proven construction techniques and management techniques was they were ever able to increase the work effort. The expert looked at all these types of blocks, including blocks that didn't require a rebar, and the continuous grouting, and found that the same rate applied even to those more complex areas. So the argument that this was so complex that it cost a $2 million overrun on a $1.6 million contract is just not a correct argument. Because no matter what type of block was being laid, we had the same pace. The other issue in this area was the issue of notice. Now let me back up. I guess the crux of the argument in the Mason productivity area, Your Honors, is even though productivity and labor effort is an assumed risk by a contractor, and a contractor builds it into his contract, and in this case there was evidence to show that there's plenty of extra built into this contract to allow for it. Weather, some slowdowns, whatever. There was a major crew of 35 that was going to be at peak points of the contract. Testimony, Mr. Murdoch made a bell-shaped curve. They projected in the contract budgeting for the entire length of the contract, the total crew. So there was slop at both ends of that bell-shaped curve to allow for all those types of assumed risk. So the real question here is, at what point does an assumed risk become so horrendous and so out of control that it's no longer an assumed risk? And that's where we were in this case, is that we had a horrendous labor effort that nobody was able to control. Recognized by Mr. Cohen early on, he had plenty of notice early on, he investigated, He did block house. He required Mr. Murdoch to continually add more manpower, do whatever it takes, spend whatever money it takes, get the job done within the time. Liquidated damages for threat. Contract went beyond the completion date, but the schedule was never changed. Liquidated damages and never, the threats never removed. Now, I think I've used up my time.
Where was Mr. Murdoch's home base?
Here in South Bend. Thank you, Mr. Larson. I'll get out to Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'd first like to introduce counsel, the seated counsel table for the co-defendant in the underlying trial, Aetna Casualty Insurance, Mr. Tom Funk, and Ms. Emily Smith. I'm going to start by following up on Mr. Wiseman's response to some of the questions posed by the judges. Yeah. First of all, Mr. Wiseman indicated that the rebar was taken into account making the estimate. Actually, the evidence of trial was that the estimators did not take into account the effect that it would have on labor productivity, and that was Judge Tender's finding. But while they did account for the cost of the rebar, they did not allow for the fact that putting this massive rebar in would have on productivity. The second one, in response to a question whether or not the only surprise on this job was the lower than expected masonry productivity, Mr. Wiseman answered yes. Actually, Judge Tender, after hearing days of evidence on the nature of this project, examining all the witnesses that were on site, fully himself, reached the opposite. That Murdoch failed to fully appreciate and comprehend the difficulty and complexity of the job.
It was underbid.
And he went on to also find that. Judge Tender found, based on all the evidence, that in preparing the estimate, Murdoch had grossly underestimated, would be misestimated, the expected labor productivity on the job. That's further confirmed by the designer. On August 25th, 1992, after Murdoch had finally brought this problem to everyone's attention, made a claim. The designer wrote a letter saying, first of all, this should have been brought up months ago. But we could have done something about it. Shouldn't have waited and incurred these extra costs. And said that we felt that the masonry crew were too small given the complexity of this job.
Now, the designer is, I'm going to go interested.
The designer, actually two designers that are in privity with the state, and everyone has to follow the orders of the designers. There's a designer and a construction manager, which was assistant to the designer, and they were agents of the owner.
Yeah, well, Goheen, I guess you'd say, works for that.
Yeah, because they work for the owner.
His complaint then that he complained to Goheen, but Goheen didn't pass it on, or what?
No, I'm saying, with regard to the complexity of the job, after Goheen passed on Murdoch's notice that it felt that masonry productivity was low, the designer responded that they felt the masonry crews had been too small.
So that was in August.
August 25th, 1996.
Well, that was pretty much too late.
And that's what that letter said. The designer said this should have been brought up to our attention a long time ago.
Well, did Goheen know about it a long time ago and enough, or is that part of
it? Well, Goheen knew about slow masonry progress and delay, and knew that, did not know that they were going to claim that that was a cause beyond their control, which touches on one of the other points, one of the answers Mr. Wiseman had. You asked the question, why did they wait so long? So the problems in this case, a cause beyond control, such as a labor dispute, is known to everybody. So notice can be given, and people have options. One of the options is to change the contractor. One of the options is to change the design. In this case, the problem was, obviously no one wants to declare that their own workforce, and that's a point that needs to be emphasized, these are union craftsmen, that they are Murdoch's employees. No one wants to announce that they do not have control of their own workforce. So what they started experiencing problems in January, they didn't form the belief until June that they felt it was out of their control, and then didn't provide any notice until August the 5th of 1992. And that's one of the problems in this case, was that they had come forward early
instead that it was a cause beyond their control, an investigation could have been done, and then options would have been given. And that's cases that we cited in our brief, two twin cases from Georgia involving actually the same contractor, the All Good Electric Associated Mechanical case, point that out, that knowledge of delay is not sufficient. Oh, we knew there were problems. And knowledge isn't equivalent to them saying, we're putting this condition out of our control, and we won't pay for it. So at that point, that should have been done early. Then we have options. One of the options could be to deny the extension, which would be an order to accelerate and incur the cost. Another option would be to get a different contractor. Different option would be to pour the concrete. But that option was never given. Also, Mr. Wiseman indicated that Local 5 was flexing its muscle and getting away with it. That's their theory. Judge Tender specifically found, after days of evidence, that there was no evidence to support the notion that the union craftsmen engaged in a concerted slowdown. The only testimony was from Ashley Bolton and Mr. Calvin Murdoch that they speculated they were dragging the job out to earn more money. Which gets to Judge Tender's second finding, which these two findings together would dispose of the case. He found there was no concerted slowdown, and he also found, as a matter of fact, their ability to control the Masons was not uncontrollable, was not beyond their control. He pointed out that they could have offered bonuses. If they were dragging the job out to make more money, could have offered a $100,000 bonus to bring it on time. That's not an economically attractive option, but it would have been an option. He pointed out that they had not exhausted all remedies to try to raise productivity.
What is the fee? My understanding was that they were averaging about 50 boss an hour, a day.
Okay, yeah, 6 to 7 per hour.
And that's substantially below what we've seen, or at least was indicated, of 150 to 200. What accounted for that? Just the difficulty with the rebar?
The complexity of the job, and that's what the district court found. It wasn't just the complexity of the rebar and the grout. That's one of the, Mr. Wiseman says all bricklayers have to do is lay brick. That's not true. In this case, they stood around a lot because bricklayers want to lay in a straight row. They would prefer to do the Chinese wall if they could. Here, you had 7 by 12 cells that formed, I think, as Mr. Perry said, a honeycomb. And they couldn't even communicate to run the grout pump. They had to be by walkie-talkies, and they could communicate, but they couldn't do it in unison. It was just a very difficult, complex job. And
so you get away when everybody gets out of the way to do your job, and they do their job, and you're standing around waiting for them to do this. You apparently can't work concurrently.
That's the problem with sequencing this job. If you lay a long wall, then the system that Mr. Wiseman describes as dust coat with the rebar and the cement grouting somewhat, that's still going to make this an enormously complex job because it's 8x8 rebar, both vertical and horizontal. It's not just, I mean, all designers are used to vertical rebar, which provides structural integrity. This is going to keep someone with too much time on their hands from breaking through a wall. So it's got an 8x8. And then on top of that, each hollow section of the block had to be grouted, not with mortar, but cement. Again, so if a prisoner with too much time on his hands tried to dig through, they'd have to go through cement.
So the cement block are filled, the two cells in the cement block are filled, and rebar is in both cells?
Well, rebar is laid like an 8x8 grid. There'd be every 8 inches, there'll be a horizontal piece of rebar laid on top of the block, each block. And then also every 8 inches vertically, they had to twist these blocks in so that you would have an 8x8 grid.
And the grout was put in, or the cement poured in after that?
Yes, after that.
Yep. So by a pump.
Yeah, they had a pump, a truck would come in, they'd have to pump it in from the other side of the wall. That was the problem because of this honeycomb design, that whenever they would radio to turn off the grout pump, what was left in the hose would come down. And unlike mortar, which can be rubbed off with a stone, cement has to be ground off with a grinder, which was one of the reasons why Bill Heenick spent $384,000.
How many stories was this structure?
Your Honor, I believe 3, because there were 2 sets of precast ceiling floors that came in on top of the brick, but I'm not absolutely certain.
It was multi-story.
Yeah, it was multi-story. I'm just not certain how many stories. Mr. Wiseman also indicated that Murdoch's estimators assumed the normal risk of labor productivity, but nothing this horrendously low. As Judge Tinder pointed out, the risk of labor productivity isn't subject to degree. Judge Tinder relied on the McNamara construction case, where they pointed out that everyone allows for a normal risk, hopes for the best. People rarely plan for the absolute worst outcome, the worst, most complex job, but that happens sometimes, as Judge Tinder pointed out. Just because they did not expect level of productivity to be this horrendous doesn't take it outside the scope of the contractually assumed risk.
Murdoch's bid was how much below the
$1 million. Roughly.
How many bidders were there on the project?
There were only four.
And what was the, do you know what the degree of difference was among the other
three? Not as great, about half, I think. The Murdoch was low by about $1 million, and then the others were spread out. Judge Tinder also found that, first of all, as a matter of fact, it's custom in the industry to rely on the bid, a fixed sum bid to put a contract. That's also consistent with the case Barry Rand versus the United States, which said that that's the purpose of a fixed sum contract. You don't have a duty. Go in and not have a duty to investigate the reasonableness of that bid. Didn't have an opportunity. Got the bid fast, 45 minutes. You had someone stationed at the state house waiting to get the facts that had never heard of Murdoch Construction before. Get the facts to 1.6, calls the state house 20 minutes later and says, working on 1.6 for the masonry, presumably they're all getting mechanical subcontract at the same time.
I'll call it a late bid just for no other label. Would he have had to use the next highest, for example, a million up as part of his bid?
Yes. Well,
would that have raised his bid up past the 6 point something?
Whether or not he was still in the lowest bidder, I'm not certain of that, Your Honor.
That was a curiosity. That if this Murdoch came in less than somebody said, and then this was 6.9 or something like that, 6.9 million.
Yeah, 6.9 million total. Yeah. Time.
So if the next he had to take the next bid, would it have been 7.9 million?
No, it would have increased it. I mean, if he couldn't have, he might have substituted other bids on mechanical electrical, but probably would have increased it by about.
But he didn't have time.
Well, he wouldn't have been
with that. That's to me, I guess, was just jammed in there last minute, and whatever his bid was, he may have a lot of profit built into that, because he was looking at the next million iron.
He just pretty much the standard 10-12%.
Well, I don't know. I was just curious about that last minute thing.
Mr. Goheen amplified on that trial, because Judge Tinder also had some questions on that. And the reason why there was, in his opinion, based on his experience, there was a disparity in the bids and not bringing in bids is because everyone knew the job was hard and people didn't want it. Starting in the winter, everyone knew this court order because prisons were overcrowded. So the notion that sometimes you can get away with being late with the state was out the window on this one. My client, Mr. Goheen, testified that, but needed to work. I think he testified quite frankly. He was just in not doing the project as well, but he needed work. He solicited bids from eight people that he commonly uses, and I think he only got two, and then he got one other, and then he got from Mr. Murdoch, who he's not familiar with. So he took a chance. Mr. Murdoch took a chance. It's unfortunate that both companies couldn't have made money, but there was a loss. The case law, which we cited extensively in our brief, will show there's no basis in the law for shifting that loss. It's unfortunate that losses in big, difficult, fast-paced jobs occur. And under the rules of contract law, the loss stays on Mr. Murdoch's payroll, which where it landed. For those reasons, one more point on the breach of contract claim, if you find necessarily on Goheen's breach of contract that the delay is excusable, then that supports the claim. Also, at this point, the breach of contract claim is somewhat moot because Judge Tinder found that including the back charges that had been paid in full. At this point, that is, the contract amount was $1.6 million. Goheen paid about $300,000 to Murdoch suppliers that Murdoch had failed to pay, and then incurred $384,000 in back charges finishing the work, which the court found was justified. As the court pointed out, they actually had been paid $50,000 more than the $1.6 million, so the breach of contract claim would only fall if this court should find a constructive acceleration claim. So for the reasons cited in our brief, and argued here today, we respectfully submit that Judge Tinder's findings and conclusions of law made after a very lengthy trial with hundreds of exhibits and several witnesses, in which Judge Tinder was very actively engaged in examining witnesses, should stand. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. I believe Mr. Weissman, you had used your time, so we'll take the case under advisement. Thanks to all counsel.